Welcome to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy. Joining me today is Dr. Heather Walker. She's the president of Westmoreland Emergency Medicine Specialist and the assistant director of emergency medicine at Westmoreland Independence Health System. So nice to have you on the show, Dr. Walker. All these important titles, and you're so special to the health system and so special to this community. And I really appreciate you coming on to talk about summer safety today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen, for having me. It's a great opportunity to help people understand how to stay better protected during the summer and really any time in general that you're going to be active outdoors.
Yes, it is. And I'd like to start a little bit by telling us about your background. So tell us where you grew up and where you trained, and then we'll talk about what drew you to emergency medicine.
So I actually grew up right in Greensburg, where I now practice emergency medicine. I did all of my training at the University of Pittsburgh. Feel very fortunate to have been given that opportunity. I finished an emergency medicine residency in 2002 and came home to work at Westmoreland Emergency Medicine Specialist, and I have been there ever since. So going on beginning of my 24th year.
Wow,
what drew
wonderful.
Me to emergency Thanks. What drew me to emergency medicine? I tend to be a puzzle solver, problem solver. And although I think in the rest of my life, I'm a fairly patient person, when it comes to medicine, I like to be able to fix things pretty quickly. So emergency medicine puts a lot of those things together. Try to solve the puzzle. I get to do some procedures, but, you know, I'm not a surgeon, things along that line. So it's a good combination of those personality traits.
And being in administration and having your hand in, you know, management probably also gives you a greater scope and a greater perspective of the other physicians within the health system that can help solve that puzzle, right? So you have good relationships. You're able to make referrals. You're able to connect the dots, so to speak.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the primary features of being an emergency physician is we often have to send people other places after we've taken care of them. So whether that be nearly always, we suggest that people circle back with their primary care physician, but they may need a specialist. They may need an orthopedic surgeon. They may need a dermatologist. They may need a kidney specialist. So it gives us an opportunity to get people to their next step. And yes, getting to know other people in the health system, the time that I've spent in hospital and health system administration has been extremely valuable in helping to get not just my patients, but all the patients from the emergency department to the correct next step after we've seen them for the first time.
Wonderful. So let's talk about a typical day. I don't know if you could call it typical. You probably never know what you're walking into at work, but why don't you tell us what that looks like?
So you're right. There is no such thing as a typical day. Even season to season, things can vary, but we take whatever comes in the door. So people say to me, well, you were busy today. What was it? And it's almost never just a single thing. The only time that that ends up being a little bit more true is during the winter, during flu season, COVID season, things like that. We may see more of one thing. But other than that, around the 12 months of the calendar, we see a wide variety of things every single day. Everything from illnesses to injuries to strokes to accidents. So you really do need to be prepared to care for anything and anyone that walks or rolls through the door.
Mm-hmm. So specifically in the summer months, since we're talking about summer safety, do you see an increase in certain types of injuries and emergencies this time of year?
Yeah, so this summer, and particularly this summer and last summer, with the increased heat and humidity that we've been seeing, particularly when we see it suddenly, we will see people, not necessarily with extreme heat illness, but things where they are being impacted by the heat and humidity. You know, maybe they're not having heat exhaustion or heat stroke, but they're feeling a little dehydrated, not realizing that it came from being outdoors so much. Older people who might have heart problems, seeing more swelling in their legs or their feet. And then obviously with everybody outside, particularly kids are outside off school, we'll see more bumps and bruises and sprains and sports-related injuries, sunburns, bug bites, ticks, things like that that tend to be a little bit more seasonal.
Yes, for sure. And when we talk about injuries and emergencies in the ER, I'm sure children and teens are probably about 50% of what you see.
I'm going to say it's hard to estimate how many, but it's quite a few.
We have our Dr. Heather Walker story when, you'll never remember this, but when it was Christmas Eve, when my oldest daughter was 3 years old, and someone at Christmas handed her a penny for some reason, for whatever reason, handed her a penny, and she never put anything in her mouth until right then on Christmas Eve, and put it in her mouth and swallowed it. And we had to bring her to the emergency room, and there's Dr. Walker laughing with us and taking the x-ray. And I'll have to send it to you sometime because we still have the x-ray. And do you know that that penny came out a nickel? It came out a nickel. It was not a penny. It was a nickel.
Wow. That's a good money-making scheme for you.
Yeah.
But you know,
these kids are unpredictable. They're in the pool. They're on the trampoline. They're playing sports. And I'm sure, like you said, bug bites are big. What are you seeing about ticks this year or just in the last few years?
Yeah. So in the last few years, the amount of tick-borne illness that we're seeing is definitely increased. Not that we didn't have ticks and Lyme disease and, you know, a few other tick-borne illnesses, but as you read and hear about climate change, there is an increasing theory that because our summers are hotter and our winters are not as cold, that we're seeing more ticks survive through the winter in this region, and therefore more ticks, more ability to carry tick-borne illnesses. So, you know, gosh, like I said, I've been doing this more than 20 years. 20 years ago, we would see somebody that had been bitten by a tick. We'd be less concerned about Lyme exposure or Lyme disease. Now, we're almost always and pretty much always doing preventative treatment for people with any concern about Lyme disease. Now, the difference there is if they say, wow, that tick's been on there for a very short amount of time. There's times that if we know the tick has been on for a very short amount of time, we carefully remove the tick if it's still there and just give them close information about what to watch for Lyme disease. But with the increasing amount of both Lyme disease and several other tick-borne illnesses, we are opting more and more for preventative treatment just because we're seeing it much more than we used to in this area.
Is there a difference in reaction to a tick bite between an adult and a child, or does it really, age doesn't matter?
Age doesn't matter when it comes to a tick. The tick doesn't care. So, and neither does the bug that the tick is carrying. So not necessarily. I will tell you probably one of the more challenging things, not based on age, but sometimes skin tone can make it a little bit more challenging to see the classic rash. And again, not everyone gets the classic rash, but when we're worried about Lyme specifically, people can develop what's called a bullseye rash. Mm-hmm. So it's a red, mostly circular rash that gets white in the middle. But again, if you're very, very tan, or if you happen to be a darker skinned individual, that rash may not have that classic appearance that's taught to everybody to look for.
Interesting. Well, it's good to know that we're all actually, I think the heightened awareness and about it is a good thing. I really do. I think that we're all more on the alert to check for things like that, which is good. So moving on to backyard fun, of course, the trampolines, the bikes, the playground equipment, any mistakes, anything that you would say, if I could tell parents one thing about playing in the backyard, it would be what?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I have two things out of that list that you just presented there. So when my son was small, bike helmets were thankfully had become a very normal thing. So it wasn't unusual. If you're going to go ride your bike, put your helmet on. But the rule in our house was not just about a bike. It was if it has wheels, it needs a helmet. So bike, scooter, ripstick, rollerblades, you know, et cetera, et cetera. If it has wheels, you need a helmet. So I think that is something that you should normalize for your children from the time that they're small enough, old enough to get on a bike or a scooter, because then there's less pushback as they get older. You know, they're not going to wait till they're five and then all of a sudden put a helmet on their head. So I think that is paramount importance. Head injury is very avoidable, or at least the severity of a head injury is able to be decreased by wearing a helmet. So if it has wheels, you should have a helmet on. It is, I think, a good rule of thumb there. When it comes to trampolines, definitely the American Academy of Pediatrics, and not quite with as strong language, the American College of Emergency Physicians, have taken a no trampoline is a good trampoline approach, particularly for backyards. Now, the exception to that is, for instance, if you're in a gymnastic studio or cheer facility, those are whole different kinds of trampolines supervised by specially trained coaches. That's very different. But when it comes to backyard trampolines, the potential for injuries is very high. Now, that being said, I think both of these medical organizations are also realistic and know that not everyone is going to avoid having a trampoline at their house or in their backyard. So some common sense things are, you know, think about how do kids get hurt on a trampoline? So they bump into each other. They fall from the trampoline, either trying to get on it or off it. The trampoline surrounding structure, the netting, isn't intact. God forbid they bounce off the trampoline onto the yard or anything else that's surrounding it. So what really is recommended, if you do choose to have a trampoline and allow your child to use it, they really suggest that children should be 6 years or older to be safer on a trampoline. Ideally, there should only be one child on the trampoline at a time because it eliminates those collision injuries. We had a couple neighborhood kids, again, when my son was small, bounced into each other, ended up with a whole bunch of loose teeth and, you know, cuts on the forehead and things like that. There should really be an adult supervising the trampoline at all times, whether there's one child or more than one child involved. And other little things, you know, you shouldn't do the double jumps. You shouldn't try to launch each other. They suggest limiting things like flips and somersaults where you could land awkwardly on your neck. So, you know, common sense things. And again, I was to a certain extent the no fun mom. I think if you would have asked my son at that time, but, you know, there are things that you can choose to be fun, but try to minimize the risk at the same time.
No question. I you know, I was a TV news reporter for years. And when I was in Altoona, I did a story with an insurance agent. And back then, of course, you know, this was 20 years ago, so I couldn't speak to how it is today. But back then, getting a trampoline actually increased your homeowner's insurance premium because it was considered to be that dangerous.
Absolutely. And I think that is still likely true if you are willing to disclose to your insurance company that you have a trampoline in your yard. You know, I think that absolutely is true because we see kids with obviously scratches and abrasions and cuts and things. But as I said, we see dental injuries, we see concussions, we see broken bones. So I think probably from the perspective of the insurance company, those things are all avoidable if you simply don't have the trampoline. So I would guess, Jen, that probably still holds true.
Yep. So let's talk about water. And, you know, you talk about the adult supervision on the trampoline. I'm sure it's equally as important with the pool.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Actually, it may be even more important with the pool. You know, drowning, sadly, has many years recently been the highest rate of death in children ages four and under. Children ages one through three actually are the highest risk for drowning. They're curious, they're mobile, but yet they're not quite old enough to understand why that water could be dangerous. So it's very much recommended that younger children, well, all children should be continuously supervised when they're in a pool. Things like having a water watcher, a dedicated adult who is doing nothing except watching those children in the pool. They're not reading a book. They don't have their phone. They're not socializing with other parents. They should be doing nothing but focusing on the pool. But the younger the children are that they are supervising in the pool, the American Academy of Pediatrics uses something that they call touch supervision. So younger children should have an adult in the pool. The adult should be close enough to reach out and touch them so that if they do start to go under, they can immediately be saved from their airway being under the water for any length of time.
It's really, really good advice because they might seem fine at first. The kids might even be progressing with their swimming, but everything could change. And you know, my parents always worried about the diving. We had an above ground pool growing up, and they were just so afraid of the jumping and the diving.
Yeah, and I think with good reason. I mean, you can still see, and it's not hard to search, you know, the internet or search social media and see someone who became paralyzed by diving into a body of water, whether it was a swimming pool, like an above ground pool, or a natural body of water, not realizing how shallow that it was. You know, the classic example is you dive into a shallow body of water, you hit your head off the bottom, it causes neck and spinal cord damage that may be incorrectable at that point. So yeah, the jumping, the diving, they really recommend that you don't jump or dive into a pool that is more shallow than 9 feet, which, you know, in Western Pennsylvania, most home in-ground pools are not 9 feet deep, even at their deepest part. So, you know, just something to be mindful of. I think as kids are, you know, let's face it, they're kids, they're going to jump into a pool. Encouraging them to jump feet first can decrease that risk. Again, it doesn't eliminate that risk, but the head first diving tends to be the riskiest activity to do that.
This is a great interview and a great lesson, a great reminder for all of us for summer safety. You're listening to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy. My guest today, Dr. Heather Walker. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about what is heat stroke, the importance of hydration, and how families can avoid the common ER visits during summer vacation. We'll be right back.
Classic Hits 107.1. Listen live at WHJBFM.com.
Welcome back to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy. Joining me today is Dr. Heather Walker. She's president of the Westmoreland Emergency Medicine Specialist, and she's also the assistant director of the Westmoreland Emergency Department at Independence Health System in Greensburg. And we're very happy to have her on the show today. She's been an excellent interview and really just giving these common sense reminders about trampolines, about pools, about bug bites. It's been really good to talk to you about that. It's a great reminder for parents of how to keep children safe. But I want to talk now about sort of some of the warning signs about heat. I mean, it has been one of those summers where it's either raining outside or it's chokingly hot. I mean, the humidity and the heat has been terrible. And you always hear about heat stroke, but can you explain what is that? Is that like a term that an urban legend that we made up, or is it a real thing?
No, it's sadly not an urban legend. Heat stroke is a medical diagnosis, and it is the most extreme of the heat illnesses. Now, fortunately, because we do have some common sense and survival skills kick in, thankfully, very few people get all the way to heat stroke. But to give you an idea, heat stroke actually has some very concrete definitions when we think about it as a medical provider. It requires things like a body temperature that is higher than 105 degrees. People are confused. They get general weakness. They're not able to walk or balance. They start to have things like a very high heart rate, but yet a very low blood pressure. So they're not perfusing very well. They get nauseous, they can vomit. And because they are dry, they get to the point that you go from profusely sweating at the earlier stages of heat illness to the point that these people are often very dry as you touch their skin. You know, they're very hot, but yet they're dry when you touch them. So that gives you an idea that perhaps they have crossed that imaginary line into heat stroke. Now, as I said, thankfully, this doesn't happen as often because we do have some survival instincts that would tell us, hey, go get yourself cooled off. So the people who are at most risk of heat stroke are those at what we call extremes of age. So elderly people, people with mobility issues, or small children and infants who aren't mobile on their own. So, you know, we will sometimes see people a couple summers ago, I have one in mind, an elderly person fell outside and then couldn't get themselves back out of the heat. You know, or God forbid, somebody doesn't realize their infant's in their carrier in the sun for a long period of time. And they can't realize why they're fussy because obviously the child can't tell them that they're too hot. So thankfully, it is a pretty rare occurrence, but it is a real thing. Now, there's the earlier stages of that. There's something called heat exhaustion. Those people are starting to feel poorly. And again, thankfully, most people will then do some things to cool themselves off. But they develop headache. They may feel dizzy. They'll notice that they're very, very warm, sweating profusely. They can get nauseous. They might realize they're feeling more tired than would make sense, either for the time of the day or the activities that they're doing. So when that happens, we encourage people try to get out of the heat, out of the sun, if you have the ability to get into an air-conditioned environment, and then increase your hydration at that point. And really don't go back out into the heat until you're feeling significantly better. And if you get to the point that you're feeling those symptoms, try really to avoid being back in the heat for the rest of that day, if that's possible and realistic for you.
Can it bring on, I mean, even if you don't get to the point of heat stroke, being in the heat and the sun, that can probably agitate and irritate some other underlying conditions if you have those sort of comorbidities, right? If you have other things wrong, Absolutely. It can make it worse. Yeah. Is that right?
Absolutely. It can. You know, and people are at increased risk to develop heat illness if they have other comorbidities. People who have heart disease or diabetes, they are definitely at increased risk to develop a heat-related illness. But yeah, because all of these things can create what we would term physiologic stress. So if you have heart disease, you're going to put additional stress and strain on your organs if you develop heat exhaustion that your body may not recover as well or as quickly. Or, you know, goodness, you hate to think of the extremes. It would be rare, but not impossible to say, well, if my cardiac health is marginal enough, could I inadvertently trigger a heart attack? It, theoretically, yes. You know, we talk in the winter about snow shoveling heart attacks. You know, so it's one of those, you do need to be careful if you have comorbidities about other physiologic stresses. And I would include heat exposure on that list.
So let's talk about hydration. So are you a Gatorade fan, liquid IV? Did you make your kids drink? What do you tell sports players to drink out there in the heat and the sun?
So, I mean, I think there's a couple things, you know, we'll get to our athletes and our kids in a second, but I think for most people, just daily water would be enough. But you get to the point, the longer you're going to be outside, the more exertion and activity that you're doing outside, you at least want to consider the occasional sports drink, you know, whether it's Gatorade, Powerade, Liquid IV, Pedialyte even has started to make things that they're labeling more for sports and activity. So I really think any of them are okay. You need to really think about how long am I going to be outside? How hot is it? How much exertion am I doing? So sports drinks end up being at least a piece of hydration, the more of those check boxes that you hit. So if it's going to be 90 and not 75, something to keep on your mind, the more humid it is. if you're going to play one one-hour game, maybe not as important as I'm going to an all-day tournament. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we'll even see baseball players, for instance. You know, that might be a 2-3 hour game, and they may not be continuously exerting themselves, but they are standing in that heat without the ability to cool off for that extended period of time. Or, you know, places that these, you know, kids now with weekend and travel sports, AAU tournaments, travel baseball, you're playing back-to-back-to-back games. Things like that, you want to consider at least some sort of sports strength. They're all fine. You know, there's no magic to, oh, one is the best. Sports strengths really have the claim to fame quite accurately. They have some sort of sugar, whether it's glucose or fructose or, you know, some combination of that. But then they have electrolytes, and it tends to be sodium, chloride, potassium. Really, those things just sort of help your body hold onto and pull more water or liquids into your bloodstream a little bit more quickly. Now, I'm a big proponent of the both. So if you are needing sports drinks, you also still need water. So, you know, you want to make sure that you're balancing back and forth. But again, the higher the temperature, the higher humidity, the more exertion you're doing, and the longer you're going to be out there, you may want to consider adding at least some sports drink to your day.
Good advice. And I think the last question today is really helping parents and families understand what warrants an ER visit and what warrants an urgent care visit. And you're probably going to say, ask your primary care doctor. But, you know, in the absence of that, right, what are some things that you should never ignore and say, absolutely, this is an ER visit, no matter what?
Right. I mean, I think of any age, I think things like confusion or things that we group onto a larger umbrella of altered mental status, those should always be an emergency department visit, hands down. Beyond that, you know, it gets harder and harder to draw that line, you know, between what particularly for children could go to an urgent care and what could go to an emergency department, because I think for most things, either it is fine, but both for children or adults, anything that we would call altered mental status should definitely be an emergency department visit. Other things, particularly for an adult, chest pain should always be an emergency department visit. Shortness of breath should always be an emergency department visit. And we are seeing a lot of kids with asthma with this humidity who are having increased asthma attacks because of that. So, you know, those things I think you should really much more steer towards an emergency department. The other things, I think you have to use common sense in your own judgment. How bad is it? How much pain is somebody in? If you have what looks like a clearly broken bone, maybe an emergency department as opposed to an urgent care, but that doesn't mean that an urgent care can't help you perfectly sufficiently. So I think that depends on you, your common sense, your own personal preference, and just kind of take it as it comes. The good news is if you do show up at an urgent care with something that maybe should have gone to an emergency department, they will help make arrangements for you to get to the emergency department of your choice. So, you know, again, I think most summertime things could be handled at either, except for that short list that we gave.
Dr. Heather Walker is the president of Westmoreland Emergency Medicine Specialists and the assistant director at the Westmoreland Emergency Department of Independence Health System in Greensburg. It's been a pleasure talking with you today about summer safety. Great job, and thanks for all the reminders.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, and hopefully everyone enjoys their last few weeks of summer.
You're listening to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy. If you have an idea for the show, please reach out to WHJB. This show airs every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. on WHJB. I'm Jennifer Mealy. Thanks for listening.